Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to MitoAction's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Amy Goldstein, Clinical Director of the Mitochondrial Frontier Program at CHOP, is with us to share neuropathy and disorders of mitochondrial dysfunction. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm the Patient Support Coordinator at MitoAction and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcast, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature on the bottom menu bar of your screen. The chat section is for you to talk with other families and clinicians who are in this space today, but it's really, really helpful if you put all of your questions for the presenter in the Q&A section and not in the chat, because this helps me to stay better organized when we kick off our Q&A time at the end of today's presentation. We will do our best to get through as many questions as possible. Today, Dr. Goldstein will review the neurological system and the differences between types of neuropathies. She will explore what conditions neuropathy is most associated with, how neuropathy is diagnosed, testing options, and caveats behind testing. She will also share current management strategies, including medications, equipment, and trials. So, without further ado, I would like to introduce Dr. Amy Goldstein. Dr. Goldstein is a child neurologist with a subspecialty focus and expertise in primary mitochondrial disorders. She was previously at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh in the Division of Child Neurology as Director of Neurogenetics from 2004 until 2017, and is currently the Clinical Director of the Mitochondrial Medicine Program at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where she sees pediatric and adult patients. In addition, she holds academic appointments at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. Dr. Goldstein is directly involved in clinical care and clinical research through natural history studies and interventional clinical trials. She actively engages with patients and families through the patient advocacy groups, including MitoAction and UMDF. She's published numerous peer-reviewed articles and has been a board member and past president of the Mitochondrial Medicine Society. She strives to improve the field by providing education via grand rounds and invited lectures, including previous FDA engagement for Leigh syndrome, Barth syndrome, and most recently, our MELAS PFDD meeting. Dr. Goldstein, I know that you are not only beloved by me, but the entire Mito community. We really appreciate all of your time, your hard work, and everything that you do. And thank you so much for taking time to explain neuropathy to us. This is a big subject, and so we just really, really appreciate your expertise.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me. And you got me reinterested in neuropathy doing the deep dive, especially for fatty acid oxidation disorders. And I had the opportunity to go to the meeting in Japan and present about this for the INFORM meeting. So thank you, Stephanie. And thank you for everybody who's joining. This is a topic that I do need to address very frequently in clinic. And I will say that this is not an easy topic, even for the adult neurologists who are managing patients with neuropathy all the time. So with that, I will share my screen and we can get started here. Stephanie, you'll tell me if you can see the presentation.
I can see it if you want to go ahead and. Yep, there it goes.
Okay, great. And I'm just gonna shrink this and move that out of the way. Okay, so we're going to talk about neuropathy and disorders of mitochondrial dysfunction. And the title is meant to really get at the get at the issue of we're really going to be talking about fatty acid oxidation disorders and primary mitochondrial disorders. And we're not going to really explore secondary mitochondrial dysfunction, if that's a term that you've heard, but to really explore these two topics. And fatty acid oxidation disorders, while that happens, those biochemical reactions and processes happen within the mitochondria. They are really not considered primary mitochondrial disorders, and they're really considered more inborn errors of metabolism and taken care of by people who practice genetics and metabolism. However, there's a lot of overlap in terms of their physiology and some of the symptoms that we can see. And again, when I started exploring this more in this past year, I was really quite intrigued by what I found. And so we're gonna talk about that. But first, we're gonna go over a little bit of a background on neuropathy. So that was just the advertisement for the session. So what is neuropathy when we talk about neuropathy? And we're gonna focus on genetics or the inherited neuropathies. And another word we can use for this is peripheral neuropathy. So we're talking about the part of the nervous system that does not involve the brain and the spinal cord, but what happens after that, the peripheral nerves. So the nerves that exit your spinal cord and serve your arms and your legs and your face, the cranial nerves. And we're going to talk about the autonomic nervous system as well. But first, we'll talk about peripheral nerves. And there is kind of a basket term or an umbrella term for many of the inherited peripheral neuropathies. And these can be called Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease. And one of the things that I try to emphasize to the adult neurology residents is that if you see a patient that has been diagnosed with Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease, one of the most important things you need to ask is, how are they diagnosed? And was that based on genetic testing or just clinically? Because a lot of things can be called Charcot-Marie-Tooth that were diagnosed clinically based on appearance, based on not having deep tendon reflexes or what we call areflexia, or the look of the foot, and we'll talk about that. But that it doesn't necessarily mean that there has been a positive genetic test. So if we look at all comers, all inherited peripheral neuropathies, meaning a genetic cause of the neuropathy and not from another cause such as diabetes or a toxin that's causing the neuropathy, the estimated prevalence is 40 out of 100,000. So that makes it one of the most common hereditary neuromuscular disorders. And there are different ways we classify neuropathy. We can talk about whether it's affecting the motor part of the nerve or the sensory part of the nerve, or we can combine that and call it sensory motor. And then we want to know, is it affecting the myelin or the axon of the nerve? So neuropathies can be demyelinating, where the myelin is destroyed, or axonal, meaning the actual nerve itself is destroyed. And a lot of people like to make an analogy that this is like a wire with insulation, right? So the myelin is the insulation to the wire. It helps the electricity be conducted faster, but the axon is the actual wire. So if that gets destroyed, it's like cutting the wire versus stripping the insulation off the wire. Usually, the inherited neuropathies will present early on, the first or second decade of life, but there is a very wide variety that we see in most things that are in this category of disease. So these can present from early infancy to late adulthood. What are the symptoms? Typically, this is a symmetrical distal, meaning far away from the body. So it'll start in the feet, and this can start with weakness and atrophy. So we can see muscles that just start getting smaller, disappearing. Muscles of the feet, muscles of the calves will get smaller. So skinny little legs, especially below the knee. And then once something will ascend up to the knee, the hands can then also start getting involved. There can be a sensory loss. And for many people, a lot of people will ask about pain and tingling and numbness, all these positive symptoms. And I don't mean positive in a good way. Here I mean positive, meaning there are symptoms like that, like pain and tingling and numbness, but there can be negative symptoms, meaning a loss of sensation where there's numbness. Or I've had people describe this as like they're walking on marshmallows, walking on pillows. They can't feel the floor beneath their feet. And that becomes very important when we talk about balance and also some dangerous things like what if you cut yourself and you can't feel it, right? So loss of pain, loss of vibration, loss of proprioception or that position sense. There can also be deformities. And this is what I was talking about earlier when people get diagnosed with CMT or Charcot-Marie-Tooth. Are there any deformities that have happened? A change in the arch. Pes cavus is when the arch becomes very high, or pes planus is when the arch becomes non-existent and now it's all flat. Hammer toes is when the toes start curling over, or even clawing of the fingers. So again, when the peripheral nerves are involved, and that will be arms and legs, the longest nerves can be affected first. So it can start in the feet and ascend up to the knees. And then the hands can start being involved, and the hands can curl, and you can get clawing of the fingers, and then the wrist can start curling under. Reduced or absent tendon reflexes are common in neuropathy, and we also call that areflexia. And again, typically this will be painless with a loss of sensation, but these can be debilitating, okay? Because if you can't feel where you are, and then especially if you close your eyes or it's dark, you will have no idea where your body is in space and you will fall over. So this can be very debilitating. Typically not life-threatening unless, again, you can't feel what you're doing and you cut yourself and get an infection. And this can lead to amputation, this can lead to sepsis. And obviously this can cause a huge impact on quality of life. When we look at all inherited neuropathies, there are more than 100 genes, and these can be of different inheritance patterns. So, autosomal dominant, autosomal recessive, X-linked, and mitochondrial genes. And these can be of different classifications. These can be involved in the peripheral nerve structure, the production of myelin, the axon transport, getting things to and fro, up and down that axon. And remember, the nerve that goes to your big toe, that's one axon from your spinal cord all the way down your leg to your toe. This is a very long axon, several feet. So things that have to go all the way to the bottom, there's a lot of transportation that's taking place. And also mitochondrial dynamics. So by that we mean fission and fusion. The mitochondria are coming together and then breaking apart, undergoing fusion and fission, and helping with that axonal transport. And there are some very important genes that are involved in mitochondrial fission and fusion that can cause neuropathy. Normal functioning of neurons and the long axons is dependent on mitochondrial fission and fusion for this transport. And also, they're involved in energy production, calcium buffering, and other essential cellular functions. And then there are many different tests that have evolved over time to help test for neuropathy. We can do something called EMG, or electromyograph and nerve conduction study. And that's when we can put sensors on the nerve and send a pulse of electricity to measure what the nerve conduction is doing. And then they can insert a needle into the muscle to measure the muscle activity. And that helps establish what's happening in the nerve. We can also do a muscle ultrasound because remember, the nerve is the wire that goes between your spinal cord and your muscle. It's just conducting electricity. So the muscle, even when we do a muscle biopsy, can tell us, is there a neurogenic change that's happening that's causing the muscle to atrophy or the muscle to be weaker. We can also do a sural nerve biopsy. A sural nerve is a long nerve in the leg, and it's a sensory nerve. So we can do that to see what's happening to the myelin. Is there something else wrong with the nerve structurally? And as I said, we can do a muscle biopsy. And then, of course, we can do, especially for fatty acid oxidation disorders and mitochondrial disorders, metabolic testing and genetic testing. And here, this is where we talk about things like urine organic acids, acyl-carnitine profile, and then, of course, the genetic testing of nuclear genes or mitochondrial genes. So, this is a graph of the spinal cord and the peripheral nerves as they come out. And I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but just to give you a sense of motor or sensory. So, from the brain, we have descending tracts, and that's going to synapse, and there's gray matter that's coming down here. And when we talk about sensory versus motor, the brain, the motor cortex, is going to be saying, I want to move my leg, I want to move my finger. So that's going to come out ventrally and go to the peripheral nerve here, and then eventually go to the muscle. However, when we have sensation, the opposite is going to occur. We're going to touch something with our finger or our foot, and the impulse is going to come up and then synapse in something called the dorsal root ganglion, or the DRG. And then that's going to come up in through the peripheral nerve and go up in the dorsal side of the spinal cord, and then ascend up to the brain, and then go to the sensory area of the brain for interpretation. So two sides of the spinal cord will take care of motor versus sensory, and then you can see there are two different sides of the peripheral nerve that will carry either the motor fibers or the sensory fibers. And again, if there's myelin that's being stripped off of this peripheral nerve or the nerve is severed, you're going to end up with both motor and sensory problems. Sometimes we have a predominant sensory problem, sometimes we have a predominant motor problem. But in these disorders that we're talking about today, it's very much often it's a mixed picture. How can we tell if there's an axonal problem or demyelinating problem? And again, same thing, many times it's mixed. It can be axonal and demyelinating. But this is a picture of a normal nerve conduction study. And this is just a graph showing how many milliseconds it takes. And this is normal. And when we have a cut in the wire, okay, so the axon is broken, we're still going to have normal speed, but you can see the amplitude here is very low. Okay, normally the amplitude is here, and you can see here the scale is 10 millivolts. So here the amplitude is lower. Demyelinating, again, the whole purpose of having myelin, the coating or the insulation for that wire is to make the electricity go faster. So if the myelin is destroyed and stripped, we now have a slower conduction velocity. And so it's slowed down. We still have the same amplitude, right? We still have that same peak, but you can see this is now taking double the time to get there. And so again, this is if we put a sensor here and a sensor here, and I shoot a bolt of electricity as if you put your finger in an electric socket, we're measuring how fast did that electricity go from here to here, and we're trying to measure that in milliseconds. Again, I can tell if somebody has axonal loss by that amplitude or demyelinating neuropathy. Okay, so again, just trying to help you with some of the definitions that you might see from some of the testing. Then we have the subject of dysautonomia or small fiber neuropathy. So something I did not show you on that spinal cord graph with the peripheral nerves, those are large motor fibers or large sensory fibers. Those are myelinated fibers. We also have small fibers that are unmyelinated that will help take care of pain, but also they will also help with our autonomic nervous system. And we can also call dysautonomia, which is dysregulation of the autonomic nervous system. People can also call this autonomic dysfunction or autonomic neuropathy. So we think about this as the automatic nervous system. And again, this is regulated by small fibers, the unmyelinated neurons. Okay, so this takes care of our blood pressure, our body temperature, what nerves go to our sweat glands and help with temperature regulation, our breathing, our digestion, our heart rate, and again, sweating. So we can have some serious symptoms and complications such as tachycardia, bradycardia, right? The heart rate, fainting. So sometimes syncope is related to this as well. Trouble breathing, the smooth muscle in our bowel and bladder. So we can have disrupted digestion or bladder function and temperature instability. So those are some major quality of life issues from small fiber neuropathy or dysautonomia. There are many other symptoms of dysautonomia, and this is from a web page from Cleveland Clinic. Some of these I already discussed, but nausea, vomiting from some of the GI issues. Brain fog can also be part of this. Pupillary changes, and one of the things that I typically notice in patients with dysautonomia is they have very big eyes, very big pupils. Fatigue can be part of this. Sexual dysfunction can be part of this. Clammy or pale skin, trouble sleeping, trouble swallowing, even hypoglycemia can be from dysautonomia and not a predominant endocrine problem or related to insulin issues or things like that. So there can be many other symptoms that can be attributed to dysautonomia. Okay, so with that introduction to neuropathy, again, including the large myelinated fibers and the small unmyelinated fibers, we're going to jump in to some of the fatty acid oxidation disorders. And here I'm going to focus on the one that has the most neuropathy, which is trifunctional protein deficiency, or TFP. And this is a little something from Gene Reviews. So, trifunctional protein deficiency is also sometimes called LCHAD. And there are two genes responsible for this disorder, HADHA and HADHB. And there are several ways that this can present. Sometimes, and many times now, this is on the newborn screen. So, babies can be picked up on the screening, but it doesn't necessarily have to present in the newborn period. Sometimes there is a later onset, which has been considered a milder form, or this neuromyopathic form. And these are people that can present with myopathy, so exercise intolerance, muscle cramping, which we call myalgias, or rhabdomyolysis, which is the muscle breakdown. And typically, these are high numbers. So, not just over 5,000, we're talking 50,000 of CK. However, there can also be a neuropathy, and many times the neuropathy will precede episodes of recurrent myoglobinuria. And this can cause distal weakness, the foot deformity, loss of ambulation, and in classic trifunctional protein, we can see this, and this is very unique to the this particular fatty acid oxidation disorder. And this is even despite newborn screening, so early detection and early treatment. So even if a baby's born with detection, treatment's put into place right away, maybe the baby's put on MCT treatment, or triheptanoin treatment, and they're on carnitine right away, and they're being treated for hypoglycemia prevention, cardiomyopathy, they can still develop this neuropathy. And so there's a lot of unknowns. And when I went through the literature, what I found is that a few things were very interesting. Number one, neuropathy can be the presenting feature in some patients. They don't have to have hypoglycemia. They don't have to have a cardiomyopathy. You can start off having neuropathy, and this can resemble Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease on a nerve conduction study. In addition, as I said, treatment will not prevent the neuropathy from happening. And below, you can see some classic pictures of what this pes cavus, this very high arch, which you can see, and then the hammer toes. The toes are just bending over. And here, hopefully, you can appreciate the clawing of the fingers. There can be contractures. And also here, if you look at your own hand, hopefully, what you can see next to your thumb, we call this the thenar eminence. You have a big bulgy muscle here because our thumbs are very important for us as humans, right? We use our thumbs a lot. But in this person, hopefully what you can see in this picture is that it is literally caved out. There's no thenar eminence there. There's atrophy of the thenar eminence. Okay, and that happens from long-standing neuropathy of the hand, right? You have muscle atrophy from that neuropathy. Okay, so again, all of these papers going back to 2003, 2004, and then even up to modern papers, 2021. When we look at children, and again, we really focus on some of the more life-threatening issues with kids with LCHAD and TFP, the cardiomyopathy, the hypoglycemia. But in these papers, the majority of kids have peripheral neuropathy at the time of diagnosis. One of the things that I was really surprised about when I started doing this deep dive in the neuropathy associated with LCHAD and TFP is, I spend a lot of time looking at neuropathy in terms of mitochondrial disease, and I'm very familiar with Stefan Zuchner's work. He does a lot of work. I'm going to start mentioning mitochondrial genes. He does a lot of work in Charcot-Marie-Tooth genes, MFN2. He is like the world's expert in MFN2. Anytime we have a variant of unknown significance, I'm emailing him. Have you seen this variant before in MFN2? What do you think about this? He is in Miami. He has this beautiful inherited neuropathy consortium called Genesis. He has studied neuropathy for decades now. There's also a webpage called Treat NMD, and that's a really great webpage. There's also a Hereditary Neuropathy Foundation. I went to their webpage, which is down below. They have a CMT tab. They now have a mito tab. But even on some of the Charcot Marie Tooth websites, there's no tab for fatty acid oxidation disorders there. And there are, let's say somebody does not have a diagnosis yet of a fatty acid oxidation disorder. And this has happened where people can be missed on newborn screen, especially the teenagers and adults. Let's say that, 16 years ago, 20 years ago, their state did not have this fatty acid oxidation disorder on their newborn screen, and they did not develop newborn symptoms. They did not develop childhood symptoms of hypoglycemia or cardiomyopathy, but they started developing a neuropathy. They're not presenting to genetics or metabolism. They're presenting to neurology, and they have walking issues. They have high arches. They have hammer toes. They may get a neuropathy panel, gene testing. I started looking on all the neuropathy panels, what genes are on it, what genes aren't on it. Some mitogenes are included, some fatty acid oxidation genes are included, but some, it depends on what panel you order, is what lab are you using? And a lot of neurologists don't have a genetic counselor in their clinic, so they can't do things like exome or genome. They're not doing all the genes. They're doing what they can do, which is a panel. There are Charcot-Marie tooth panels out there. And so if TFP is not considered a Charcot-Marie tooth disorder, it's not going to be on the panel. So after the Japan meeting, I emailed a bunch of Charcot-Marie tooth doctors and said, I think that fatty acid oxidation disorders, especially TFP, TFP should be considered a Charcot-Marie tooth disease. Why? Because now this opens up a whole new world of support. There are CMT camps. There are CMT clinics where they can get proper bracing and proper PT and proper equipment and people who know what they're doing for this specific neuropathy. And now it's considered a form of CMT, and it should be on all the gene panels. So a lot's happened in the past year, specifically for LCHAD TFP. Some more things that I explored as I was preparing for the meeting, and I'm going to gloss over some of these things, but again, just there was report after report of the degree of sensory neuropathy or neuronopathy in adults with different mutations in TFP, and especially not just in the adults but in the children. And here, this was a report describing it as axonal as opposed to demyelinating, length dependent, and again, that combination of sensory motor. Just to emphasize that children presenting with neuropathy should be screened for fatty acid oxidation disorder, do an acyl-carnitine profile, or do genetic testing, and look for exercise intolerance. And then another key feature of TFP is the retinopathy, which is also another symptom that, despite newborn screening and early treatment, the retinopathy is also something that is very hard to prevent and treat, even with other early treatment and good control of other symptoms. This was another paper from 2021 reporting that the median age of onset in neuropathy for LCHAD TFP is 8 years old. And again, that surprised me. The range, half a year old, 6 months old to 25 years old. And here they broke it down even more, telling us that 58% had neuropathy, and of those, 45% of them were sensory motor, 27% were pure motor, 27% were pure sensory, and most of them were axonal, but over time there would be a secondary demyelination, and there was an earlier onset in the patients with trifunctional protein versus LCHAD. And again, it was 5 years old versus 15 years old. And isolated peripheral neuropathy was the first and only presenting symptom in four patients that they reported. And in all four, the diagnosis was missed by newborn screening. So again, what was recognized over time is the neuropathy, I think, was being missed, and then a missed opportunity to start treating this disorder. long-term neurologic outcomes, and this was patients that did have newborn screening and were picked up. And this was a paper out of Germany, and again, same thing, showing earlier onset in patients with mitochondrial trifunctional protein. Here, the median age was 4 versus 11 years old for patients with LCHED. And again, newborn screening and early treatment improved the long term, but did not prevent the development of neuropathy. Okay, so I hope people are starting to think about questions and type them into the chat or the Q&A box, and we're going to get to those. I just wanted to, for a few minutes, talk about primary mitochondrial disorders. And there have been several papers on this over time from the group in England. I'm thinking about Rita Horvath from the Italian group, Valerio Corelli, Michelangelo Mancuso has published on this. And these have also been described with many different types, large and small fiber, axonal and demyelinating, often presenting subclinically. Again, so if you're not looking for it and then you go to look for it, you will find it. So it's not always obvious, but some of them do look very much like Charcot-Marie-Tooth. And I started adding genes, and the more genes I added, the more I felt like I had to keep adding. But some of them that are, we see peripheral neuropathy the most common in, I already talked about MFN2, which is one of those mitochondrial fission fusion genes. POLG, one of the most classic phenotypes, is neuropathy and ataxia, and I will say that's a sensory neuropathy that can give you balance issues. TYMP, which is a cause of Meingi, and that can give you a lot of GI issues with a white matter disease and a sensory peripheral neuropathy, motor and sensory neuropathy. MPV17, which is mitochondrial depletion syndrome. SLC25A46, which is a mitochondrial carrier protein, and that can give you a neuropathy. FDXR is an iron sulfur cluster disorder. So it's in the same family as Friedreich's ataxia. And similarly to Friedreich's ataxia, we can see peripheral neuropathy. What's interesting, though, about FDXR that I just want to highlight, and I may have this on a slide in a few slides. I've had a few patients, and I think this is now very recognized that you can have this condition and have mitochondrial symptoms present, and you can then have a very acute episode of demyelinating neuropathy that looks exactly like Guillain-Barré syndrome. And this is now well recognized, and it can be treated like Guillain-Barré syndrome. And I'm going to start getting into some treatment considerations. POLG, I will say the same thing. And there's a French paper that was published in the last few years where they highlighted six children that looked exactly like Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? Like an acute inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy with high protein and spinal fluid. Enhancement of nerve roots on a contrast enhanced MRI of the spine. So these look exactly like Guillain-Barré. And SERF1, I've also seen that occur where you can have enhancement of nerve roots. So these things can mimic inflammatory disorders. I also want to highlight NARP, the mitochondrial DNA disorder caused by 8993 T to G or T to C. And that's a complex five disorder, again, mitochondrial DNA disorder. And then another one I want to highlight is the 11778. This is an ElHON mutation. So Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy, we think, is predominantly going to cause blindness, but patients with this mutation can also develop a cardiac arrhythmia, and they can also develop a neuropathy. So we watch them for this. And sometimes when you have more than just the optic neuropathy, we talk about this being ElHON plus. There are many other mitochondrial genes that can cause that can involve neuropathy. So I don't mean to exclude them, but these were the ones that really stood out to me. And when I see patients in clinic, these are the patients that I'm really screening for neuropathy carefully. I will also say neuropathy can also occur secondarily as a complication of mitochondrial diabetes, especially if you've had mitochondrial diabetes for a long time. This would especially be true for our patients with Kearns-Sayre syndrome and MELAS, and those patients will also can have a tendency for neuropathy from their mitochondrial disease. If you have a large-scale deletion, most of my patients don't have reflexes and the 3243 variant as well. If you have kidney involvement or side effects from treatments, and so one of the most famous things that occurred was a treatment trial in MELAS patients using dichloroacetate, and anyone who has been following along the story of dichloroacetate or DCA, this has been in trials now more recently for a condition called PDH or pyruvate dehydrogenase deficiency. About 20 years ago, a trial was done using it for lactic acidosis in people who have MELAS, and it increased the tendency to cause a bad neuropathy, so it was stopped. And we don't give it to people with MELAS, even though it does a great job at lowering the lactic acid levels. It was causing too much neuropathy in those patients. Okay, so the next statements are recommendations from our mitochondrial medicine diagnosis and treatment guidelines. So patients with mitochondrial disease should be screened for neuropathy when symptoms suggest it. And again, this could be changing gait or complaints of not feeling things normally with the feet or balance issues. We can do an EMG nerve conduction study. We should consider it and include arms and legs. Now, I will say these are painful. Not everybody tolerates them well, and I don't order them often. I think it's important to order them if we need to confirm that there is a neuropathy and which type, especially if treatment could possibly depend on it. Screening for treatable causes of neuropathy should be obtained, especially if it's atypical for the underlying mitochondrial disease. So there are other things that can cause a neuropathy. As we said, diabetes could be more common in certain disorders. And if you can get the diabetes under a little bit better control, that could help. There are some vitamins that can cause a neuropathy. So we love B vitamins in our patients, but excessive doses of B6 in particular can cause a neuropathy. So not all vitamins, especially the ones that we think are safe and water soluble, are indeed non-toxic. So we have to be careful about these types of things. And treatment of neuropathies is symptomatic and follows guidelines established for non-mitochondrial neuropathies. There's no special medicine for mitochondrial neuropathy, and I am going to talk about medicines, I promise. And caution and close monitoring is needed for mitochondrial toxicity. And I will say, especially for people who are already having fatigue, because some of these medicines can cause either sleepiness or drowsiness, hypersomnolence, more fatigue. We don't want that, right? We don't want to cause more problems. And obviously, valproate needs to be avoided in people who have Golgi. And I have some references there for the some of the slides that I just showed. And this is from a paper that was published in 2013. And again, it just goes over some of the other genes. I mentioned MFN2. I mentioned CM. I'm sorry. I mentioned the ATP6 disorders, which would really be the 8993 variants causing complex 5. We have a lot of different names for the same thing. AIFM1, that is a disorder I did not mention yet, but that causes a condition called Kallbach syndrome, but it can also cause another phenotype. One thing I want to point out, if you look on the right, like on the left are all the mito genes, but on the right, you can see these are called CMT type 2A, CMT type 2K, CMT type 2Q, CMT type X4. A lot of these are already recognized as a type of CMT. CMT is up to maybe 80 different flavors at this point. There are a lot of different Charcot-Marie-Tooth disorders that have known genetic causes. Then there's a list of neuropathy as a key feature, neuropathy as a minor feature, and I see MRF down there. I would argue that, for some of my patients, neuropathy is not so much a minor feature of their SERF1 or their 3243 or their current SARE. But I think what's meant by that is that some of the symptoms play a much bigger role, and neuropathy is not causing the majority of the quality of life issues. But PolG, I've got plenty of adults who say the neuropathy is their whole entire problem. Okay. Again, not to belabor these slides, but SERF1, again, SERF1 is for many, many people a childhood disorder causing Leigh syndrome. So lesions in the basal ganglia that affect the brain. It can affect the brain stem and respiratory center. Many children have failure to thrive. They may need a feeding tube. They can develop a movement disorder. They can have optic atrophy. Few patients have seizures, even fewer have heart issues. But you can have a peripheral neuropathy, and when we look for it, it's present in up to 81%, which is quite high. And again, I've had patients that have undergone a sedated procedure and come out not being able to move. And then we get an MRI, and boom, there's the contrast enhanced nerve roots. And oh, is this Guillain-Barré? Did they just develop something acutely? No, it was the stress of the procedure they just underwent causing an acute neuropathy. I've had that happen to one of my SERF1 patients. FDXR, I mentioned, this is that iron sulfur cluster disorder, pretty rare. There are 44 known patients in the literature. A few more are probably known and not published, but there can be a peripheral neuropathy which can mimic Guillain-Barré and possibly responsive to the same treatments we give to people with Guillain-Barré, which is intravenous immunoglobulin. So more to say about that. PolG, and this is these are some graphs I took from Omar Hikmat's paper in 2020 when he described PolG, not naming phenotypes anymore, not calling it SANDO or ANS or anything like that, but just are you less than 12, between 12 and 40, or over 40 when you first develop your symptoms? And here's peripheral neuropathy. We don't see it as much in childhood, only 30%, but people who present between 12 and 40, 84% have peripheral neuropathy. It's very high in that age group, and along with ataxia, because the ataxia is probably due to sensory neuropathy and maybe a little bit cerebellar ataxia. Okay, now I'm going to go to the next. We're going to talk a little bit about treatment, and I found this is as I found this really neat graphic as I was going through papers just to start talking about treatment, and I just thought this was really interesting. These are some key mechanisms of neuropathic pain, because pain can be a big feature of people who have neuropathy. And so what happens is we have discharges from damaged nerve endings and demyelinating axons, and that this can lead to burning pain. We can have peripheral sensitization, and this is where we can have inflammatory mediators, right? And these are things that we can actually measure in blood, and this can lead to hyperalgesia and allodynia. The best explanation I've ever heard of allodynia is when something hurts and it really shouldn't hurt. So let's say you love being in a shower, right? Feeling that warm water hit your skin feels great, but not when you have a sunburn. Right? When you have a sunburn, you can't be in the shower. All of a sudden, your skin is that much more sensitive, and now it hurts. Okay? So pretend you don't have a sunburn, but now you're trying to go in the shower, and just that normal sensation, something that shouldn't hurt, is now hurting. That's when you have a sensitization, and that's allodynia. So there are people, for instance, who have migraine and they can't brush their hair because the scalp hurts so much. Okay, so that's again another example. And then we have ion channel alterations. And this is important because a lot of the medicines that we use for pain, neuropathic pain, are going to work on one of these ion channels. It's either a sodium channel drug or a calcium channel drug or a potassium channel drug or one of these TRPs. This is actually a really hot topic right now. And these opening and closing of these voltage gated channels can lead to increased excitability. We talked about the spinal cord and the two sides, creating either the motor or the sensory function of the nerve. And then we've got all this central can't say that word right now. Sensitization happening. NMDA receptors, which is another class of drugs, calcium influx, this wind-up phenomenon, synaptic plasticity, glial activation, loss of inhibition, and this can lead to amplified pain signals. The good news here is that we can do other things about this, either through drugs or through other kinds of therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. This is where it makes me think of people who have had limb amputation and they have like this phantom limb pain. You can do a lot of work looking in the mirror and tricking your brain into thinking the limb is still there to help get rid of the pain. I mean, these things are now proven to help work. So the clinical manifestations of neuropathic pain, I kind of went through these. You can have pain, burning, stabbing, or electrical shocks, sensations, that hyperalgesia, exaggerated response to stimuli or allodynia, pain from normally non-painful stimuli, hypoesthesia, reduced sensation in affected areas, just not being able to feel at all. Paresthesias is the word that we give to tingling or numbness or that pins and needle feeling. And then functional impairment. Like, what is it doing to you to have this pain? Is it affecting your sleep, your mood, your quality of life disturbances? And something that we've all appreciated more and more. I mean, we know that there's a domino effect that occurs, right? If you're not sleeping well, nothing's going to go well the next morning or the next day, and your fatigue is going to be even worse. If your mood is not good, then all of your symptoms are going to feel worse, and you're going to, if somebody gives you any type of questionnaire to do that next day and your mood is not good, you're going to score lower across the board, even if it's a questionnaire about your GI function. Measuring neuropathy is very interesting, and I talked a little bit about how we do that in terms of like EMG nerve conduction study. When we start talking about dysautonomia, there's all kinds of fancy things. There's pow orange powder test. There's QSAR. There's tilt table. There's all kinds of other things. You can do a skin biopsy to measure how much nerve fibers there are. There's neuroimaging. But I'm also talking about questionnaires, right? And I think that one of the things that we want to make sure of from the community, especially as we do clinical trials that want to measure neuropathy, is are we using the right questionnaires? Are we measuring this correctly? I don't want another drug to fail because we're not measuring this the right way. And so I've been looking at different scales that people want to use for either a natural history study or in an interventional therapy trial. And these are some of the things that have been thrown out there. And the Joint European Academy of Neurology, like likes to use these scales, this DN4, IDN4, and LANSS. And as Stephanie told you, there have been patient panels where we go in front of the FDA and we make sure the FDA knows about the disease. But I think the drug companies, the pharma companies, are also very interested in hearing the voice of the patient and the voice of the community and doing interviews and making sure they understand the disease and that the outcome measures, the patient-reported outcome measures, are measuring your symptoms the right way. This is so important. If you heard anything I said so far, that's the most important thing. All right, and there's some references for the previous slides. Okay, so treatment. Rehabilitation is incredibly important, and one of the things I like to do in clinic is make sure that you're with the right people. Do you have an orthotist that knows how to work with you? Are you working with a physical medicine and rehab specialist, a physiatrist, either pediatric or adult? So there's all kinds of bracing. Some of them are over the counter, not custom molded. Some of them are custom molded. You can buy a carbon fiber AFO off the shelf, or sometimes you need something that's just custom molded in the bottom of your shoe. A lot of people like to use night splints to help maintain neutrality, especially if you're starting to get a little tight in the Achilles and you're starting to not be able to get your heel down on the floor. This is important even for people who are no longer walking, for kids who need to be in a stander just for bone health and for constipation issues and for the sake of gravity and for all of that, right? And to do do things at a table. We want them in standers, but heel down is the appropriate position. So making sure that they have bracing to do that. PTOT for stretching, strengthening. If there is a contracture, considering Botox and there's or phenol or something else. Again, we need the right people to be taking care of you and the right considerations, the right muscles, not too many, not taking away function, but taking away the contracture that's causing a problem. Surgery can also be considered, but I've had people undergo surgery and have great outcomes. I've also had patients undergo surgery and have lost some ability. So again, we need the right people doing these procedures and vetting them and making sure it's somebody who knows either Charcot-Marie-Tooth or mitochondrial disease or how to get the best functional outcome from a procedure. And then we need the anesthesia team on board as well. And then what kind of rehabilitation are you going to get afterwards? Podiatry, I send a lot of my patients who have neuropathy to a podiatrist who takes care of diabetes. Why? Because they know how to take care of feet. They understand what it is to have sensory loss in feet. They will clip your toenails and make sure that you don't get an ingrown toenail, and they will make sure that you don't have any cuts on your feet. They practice amazing good foot care. And again, I don't want anyone who has sensory loss in their feet walking around barefoot and accidentally stepping on something, even if it's your child's Lego they left on the floor, because a cut that you don't feel can get infected and get nasty really quickly. So, again, don't miss that step. There's a lot of assistive technology resources out there and independence. I've learned this from my patients, mainly my patients with POLG. How do I maintain my independence if I have an ongoing neuropathy? There's also, I learned this from my rehab specialist. There's a great website called Tech Owl, which is run out of Philadelphia. But if you don't live in Pennsylvania, you can switch the state and then come up with all other types of technology resources. Centers in your city, in your state, and based on what you like. We found like a fishing center for somebody who likes fishing in another state. But if you think that you want to be able to do something and you're thinking, I can't do it because of my neuropathy, and this even goes for driving, right? Like, I can't feel the foot pedals. Okay, how do I adapt the car to do hand? The hand pedals. So all kinds of things are possible. Again, we want to avoid neurotoxic medications if you have a neuropathy. There's a beautiful list on the MDA website, and that resource is there. I think a copy of these slides can be made available, especially to that resource. So Stephanie can help with that. Okay, now we're going to talk about meds, and we're going to go through this really quickly because this is a decision between you and your clinician. This is, I'm not prescribing your medicines. And again, people have tried medicines and not done well on them. People have tried medicines and done great on them. Sometimes I'm lucky and we're there on the first try. Sometimes we're on our third medicine and still struggling to get a good fit. I try to get two birds with one stone. So if somebody's not sleeping well, I'm like, let's do something at nighttime that'll help you sleep. If somebody has neuropathy and a mood disorder, I'm like, let's try something that's also going to help you feel better. So there are different treatments for neuropathic pain. Gabapentin is one of the tried and true. The issue is that it's typically dosed 3 times a day and it can make people tired. And if you're having any type of balance issue, it can, not always, but it can make that worse. It can make sedation worse. I like it for people who only need it once a day because it will help people go to sleep. What I love about it is that there's not a lot of drug-drug interactions. It's really safe to use even for people who have had an organ transplant or, have a long list of other medications on board. There is a similar medicine to gabapentin called pregabalin, which is also called Lyrica. And this one can be tolerated a little bit better. There's more predictable absorption, faster onset. So you only need to take this once a day and it's not as sedating. I've had people do great on Lyrica who did not do well on gabapentin. I should say the other name of gabapentin is Neurontin. A medicine that I used to use a lot more of that I've kind of gotten away from are this category of tricyclic antidepressants. Don't let that name scare you. These are really wonderful medicines for neuropathic pain at low dose. Usually, to work as an antidepressant, you need much higher doses. So you'll see the range there, 25 to 150. Usually, 25 milligrams is enough to cover neuropathic pain, but if you're going to treat depression, it has to be much higher. As you go higher, the side effects absolutely will escalate. And the most common side effects, you'll see there's anticholinergic symptoms. What does that mean? It means it dries you out. Dry mouth, not being able to pee. The side effects can be pretty significant, and these can also make people tired. But on low dose, it can really work. And a great side benefit is that amitriptyline, which is called Elavil, is also FDA approved for migraine prevention. So this can be great to use. One of the other considerations is that this is a drug that can prolong the QT interval. So sometimes we'll have to follow an EKG just to make sure we can go up on dosing. So amitriptyline, nortriptyline, there's others in this category as well. The next class that I like are called the SNRIs. This includes drugs, I'll use the trade names here, Cymbalta or Effexor. And these can be extremely good for nerve pain. These can also be extremely good for anxiety and depression. And these have a better side effect profile than the tricyclic antidepressants, and you don't have to use quite such a high dose. And that dryness effect that you can get from the TCAs, you don't have as much. So I really like these. Cymbalta, especially, I've had a lot of really good luck with Cymbalta and nerve pain for patients with mitochondrial neuropathy. So one of the strategies is for sure only one medicine at a time. If we're on two medicines and you change both of them at the same time, it's way too hard to know which one's working or if there's a side effect, which one's responsible. I will try to s slowly escalate until we have either good pain relief or we have a side effect that we just can't live with. But there's no point in being on a medicine that could possibly work, but you're on too low of a dose. And so the dose is so low that it's either not working for your pain, but you're not even having side effects, but nothing's happening. Like, why stop there? And so I've seen people that somebody's a little hesitant to go a little higher, but why not? If you're not having side effect, let's push it. Let's see if we can get a little bit better effect on the dose. And if one medication fails, go to the next one. There are many, many medicines here. All right, I'm going to go to the next category. I really like topical agents because sometimes people don't want to take something enterally, right? So lidocaine patches, where you peel it, you stick it on. These are great for overnight. There's also lidocaine in a roller or a cream. Those are wonderful. Also, capsaicin comes this way. I'm not a huge fan of opioid-like medications, but I have some patients that all they'll respond to is tramadol. And they usually go to a pain specialist for that. Or they're on low dose naltrexone, and that's what they'll respond to. There's also a lot of complementary approaches. Physical therapy, I mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy or pain processing, lifestyle interventions. I've had people that are now using red light therapy. That infrared light therapy for pain and inflammation, especially for muscle, and that's been working. I don't know if there's statistics yet on how it works for pain, neuropathic pain, but people have been enjoying the red light because it's non-invasive and no side effects. Now we're stepping up a lot more, right? So this is third line. So NMDA receptors, ketamine, there are ketamine infusions. We started doing that at CHOP for children with migraine. So we have the pathway for that. Other drugs that are in that NMDA pathway, dextromethorphan is cough syrup. So you can use that orally, but that's a really high dose. But there's also intrathecal ways to use that. A lot of people ask me about what about THC and CBD? I know a lot of people who live in states where they can get this, and it can be effective. I myself am not opposed to this, but I think it's really helpful if you live in an area where you can actually go and have a conversation with somebody who knows what they're doing with these drugs and can do a combination, like the right type and the right combination, where you know what you want to target. I want to target pain and I want to be able to sleep at night. And I don't want to have that high feeling. And work with somebody who knows how to produce that right combination to be able to give you the right amount of THC and CBD, but also, again, like the right varieties of that CBD. Botox, again, a lot of people do very well with Botox. I've had a few patients that did not do well and they stopped using it. But I never say it's bad across the board for people with mitochondrial disease because some of my patients have bad contractures and I've seen some very good results. And so this is not across the board mitotoxic. And I think, again, it really is best done in the hands of somebody who's done it for other mito patients. Again, very carefully thought out. There are some hospitals and programs that have something like an advanced tone management program where you're seeing different people, ortho, physiatry, neurosurgery, neurology, PT, OT. They're all working together as a group to come up with what's the best strategy here. Do we need an ortho surgery? Is Botox okay? What about casting? What about splinting? What's the best way to take care of this contracture and have it be a mutual decision making. There's spinal cord stimulation, electric nerve stimulation through a TENS unit, and then other interventions, including nerve blocks. And again, these are more advanced cases. Some of the other things I just want to put out there, and I do want to end soon so we have time for questions. Steroids, there are a lot of concerns about using steroids in inborn errors of metabolism, like fatty acid oxidation disorders, because that can cause catabolism. But there are some historic papers where steroids were used. In mitochondrial disorders, I use steroids for certain situations. I have not used it for neuropathy, but I have used IVIG for these Guillain-Barré cases. And what looks like turns into a more chronic form of Guillain-Barré. So Guillain-Barré, we also call, and I mentioned this earlier, acute inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy. But when that lasts months, we then call it chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy, or CIDP. And for CIDP, there are treatment protocols using either intravenous immunoglobulin or sub-Q immunoglobulin. So that is something that I use for chronic neuropathy. Whether it works for mitochondrial disease, I don't think we know quite yet, and it can be a challenge to get these approved, but I'm not the only person who is utilizing that as a treatment strategy right now. Another modality that has been postulated is using this new category of drugs called JAK inhibitors. JAK stands for Janus kinase, and this is a signaling pathway, and it has to do with cytokine signaling. And again, these are just pathways of inflammation. And I will just say more to come on this. We're still learning the overlap of inflammation in fatty acid oxidation disorders and mitochondrial disorders. But if you see your clinician saying, I want to run a cytokine panel. I want to run inflammatory markers. This is why. This is why we're starting to run these. There's some work that's been done by Jerry Vockley, Melanie Gillingham, and partners looking at cytokine levels in some of the fatty acid oxidation disorders. And again, we might start seeing signals here. We're not sure how to treat it yet. So we're still, again, exploring. And this is another paper with some of their work looking at inflammatory activation in some of the FAODs. And then I'll end with this question of elamipretide. Elamipretide is now approved for Barr syndrome as Forzinity. It just ended a clinical trial for Pol-G and other primary mitochondrial myopathies. And the question is it good for Pol-G and other disorders? And is it doing anything for the neuropathy? And we have very limited experience in fatty acid oxidation disorders, but it is a conversation that we are starting to have because Dr. Vockley in Pittsburgh has some experience using it, not for neuropathy, not for cardiomyopathy, but I think in patient fibroblasts and in some cell data and in an animal model. So again, that drug is available through Stealth Biotherapeutics, only FDA approved approved right now for Barth syndrome, but I don't think we're done with elamipretide quite yet. So that was a lot of information. I'm going to stop sharing now. And Stephanie, I'm going to be very curious to see what kind of questions have popped up over the last hour.
So many questions, Dr. Goldstein. And I want to just say off the bat, guys, your questions are amazing. We are going to try to get through as many as possible. We might have to bring Dr. Goldstein back to continue this conversation because it's a really important conversation in our community. So I'm going to start with, because you didn't just mention treatment, so I'm going to start with a treatment question. You did mention a couple drug suggestions that could be done intravenously. Are there any other ones that maybe weren't listed as intravenous that you could also do intravenous? This particular patient said that their son doesn't absorb medicines very well, can only use IV meds.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of medicines that are used, via IV, like Toradol. I mean, there's so many different medicines. My recommendation would be to work either with the neurologist or with a pain specialist, right? And there are people that do pain medicine. There are also, my physiatry team is incredible. They're doing a lot for pain management with some of my patients with neuropathy. And so, I tend to work in a multidisciplinary group for some of my patients because sometimes they're thinking about what they can do and it may not have occurred to me, right? So again, I have a huge benefit. I'm in a big hospital where I do have these multidisciplinary groups and we can sit around and brainstorm what's the best option. So yes, the short answer is yes, there are IV medications. I think it brings up a lot of other topics. If it's something that needs to be given every day, then are we talking about needing a central line? For people that don't absorb oral medicines well or enteral medicines well, the other thing to consider that I mentioned are the topicals, right? Like transdermal. There are so many transdermal, right? And then there are other interventions that aren't IV medicines that have to be delivered frequently, like a nerve block. Right? Like, what about an epidural or a spinal nerve block? And again, that's where people that do interventional pain medicine can be very helpful.
So another patient asked, can nerve pain present as bone pain?
What kind of pain?
Bone pain. Can nerve
Bone
pain present
pain.
as bone pain?
One of the tricky things about pain is we use this term called referred pain, right? And I think that we think about it in kids so often, and I don't know if this person who asked is a child or an adult, but pain, my brother is a pain specialist, actually. He does these interventional pain things, and he always says, pain is subjective, right? Like, I can't tell you, if you came to me, Stephanie, and said, I have pain here, and this is what it feels like, I can't say, you're wrong, and I have a test to prove it, right? Pain is subjective. Pain is what the patient reports it is. So if a patient says, this is where I have pain, and I feel it in my bones, okay, right? And then the job of us is to figure out, well, where's that pain coming from? And I think we have tools that can rule out bone pain. I think, bone pain for me has very specific connotation, right? Like, I want to make sure there's not something in the bone that's creating that. But, so you do an X-ray or CT. Okay, it's not in the bone. Now what? What else could be causing that? Maybe it's referred from somewhere else. Maybe it is nerve pain. But pain is subjective and pain is what the patient reports. So I think the best thing to do is just try to be as honest and specific in trying to report it. Because like that's all you can do is tell the story, right?
Yeah, no, that's really helpful. This question kind of I might go hand in hand with it. This patient asked, does neuropathy and neuralgia go hand in hand?
Sort of the same things. Neuralgia is pain of the nerve. It's just the Latin for it.
Okay. All right. All right. So there's another question that was submitted previously before your presentation. This patient asked, do you recommend using a vibrating roller underneath your feet to help with neuropathy?
You can try it, and if it works, great. I mean, rollers, foam rollers are wonderful. Not everybody loves them. You might want to try it out first in PT just to make sure you're whatever doing it correctly. Some people like adding vibration. Some people have those little massage vibrator. I don't want to call it a gun, but you know what I'm talking about. And you can put it everywhere. Some people really like that and some people don't. So I think just like everything, if it feels good, do it. If it doesn't feel good, don't do it.
Can small fiber neuropathy cause dystonia in the legs and feet?
That's an interesting question. I always think of dystonia being a higher up central nervous system problem, right? For me, dystonia is coming from the basal ganglia. So I'm going to say no if it's true dystonia. Dystonia is like an abnormal posturing of the muscles, with a central cause.
Okay. So, in regards to the posturing of the muscles, there was a patient. I'm going to give you kind of a try to give you a brief overview and then see if see what you can do with this. This patient said that they've experienced multiple episodes of temporary paralysis up to 22 hours from neck down. And out of the blue posturing, and they've experienced this paralysis after procedures, which really confuses the ER docs. And so I'm going to move back because there, she followed up with a question. Have you seen something like this that's been described? Can you explain what's happening if you've seen something like this before? Obviously, you can't speak to the specific of the patient, but is this something? And I would even add to that some of our patients have waxing and waning of symptoms. So, like, is that something too, maybe that you can kind of touch base on with this?
Yeah, this one's a little complicated because I have thoughts that are going in different directions. You know, like paralysis is something separate, right? And you know, and I also would want to know, and we don't, you know, we don't have to find out the answer, but like, is this somebody who has a diagnosis, a definite diagnosis, or not diagnosed? And then, you know, people can wake up from sleep and have what's called sleep paralysis, right? And that can be like a, you know, packaged within narcolepsy. So, you know, that's one of my questions. Like, does that ever happen with sleep? Is this like a sleep issue? A coming out of a procedure makes me think about, you know, okay, this is an anesthesia concern, right? And was there, you know, a muscle paralytic used? And is this part of, you know, a problem there? Like, is this a neuroleptic malignant syndrome, malignant hyperthermia kind of problem? You know, is this with fever? You know, there's a whole host of things there. People who have paralysis that lasts hours, there's a whole other category of conditions, periodic paralysis syndromes. Some of those are channelopathies, right? That, you know, like that involve potassium, like, you know, potassium can be high, potassium can be low. It can involve, you know, a lot of other things. So there's a lot of different things that need to be explored here. So yeah, I mean, I think there's just a lot of different avenues. But and then the posturing, I don't know how to add that on other than there's some, you know, for sure there's something going on here. And and the other thing, that there was one other thing that I just wanted to bring up, which is, yeah, any other kind of electrolyte disturbance, because there was something that made me think about calcium. You know, is there any kind of tetany going on or hyperventilation kind of situation, even vocal cord dysfunction as they, you know, realize that they're not able to move and something there happening. So there's just a lot that needs to be explored.
There's a lot there. What about the waxing and waning of symptoms that sometimes come and go with mitoneuropathy or FAODs and neuropathy? Is that a whole other presentation in and of itself?
Well, waxing and waning symptoms like fatigue or pain is worse one day than another day, something like that. That is typical. But neuropathy, like it's not like one day you're going to have neuropathy, the next day you're not. You know, like once neuropathy is there, it's there,
It's
right?
there. But the feeling of it could possibly change the symptoms that go with it.
Absolutely. Pain could be better or worse, for sure.
So this patient said, my daughters have the FDXR mutation. My younger daughter passed away after they said that she had Guillain-Barré. She never recovered. My oldest has neuropathy concerns. What can I do to help her and prevent what mimics Guillain-Barré, as you said?
So I'm on a little bit of a mission right now to try to see if Regular infusions of IVIG will help prevent this. And there are not a lot of patients with FTXR. And so I don't know how many people are getting IVIG right now or the sub-Q form of it, but it is something that I am trying to explore. And I've reached out to doctors in other cities who are managing these patients to say, hey, what do you think of this idea? And I know the FDXR community is super tight. I know they're in a WhatsApp chat together. So say hi to the community for me, and help spread the word. And I know they're all deeply missing the doctor who was doing the most for natural history for their disorder and had to move out of the country. And so, we are trying to do as much as we can for this disorder. And I'm so sorry about the loss of your daughter. I really am so sorry about that. That I think that the recognition about this inflammatory neuropathy is more recent, and I think I don't want to say blindsided us, but we accumulate knowledge about some of these mitochondrial disorders at a slower pace than I would like. And the other thing I will say, and this is also going to be controversial, is that we have several disorders that are in this iron sulfur cluster family, like Friedreich's ataxia. Friedreich's ataxia has an FDA-approved therapy, right? They have Skyclarys. And how do we know that Skyclarys is not going to work for the disorders that are in the same pathway? And so I happen to work at CHOP. I've got the world's expert in Friedreich's ataxia down the hallway from me. And what's really hard about this drug is it's very expensive, and we know that they don't want to approve it for people who don't have Friedreich's ataxia. And so, I'd love for the drug company to say, you know what, let's go ahead and open a new study and let's study people who have Friedreich's ataxia-like disorders, like FDXR, like IBA57, like, NUBPL, right? The other ones that are in this family. And let's see if Skyclarys will work for them too. So there's more. We're up to something with FDXR. Don't worry. We're trying hard.
Thank you, Dr. Goldstein. There's a Duke researcher for TFP gene therapy, and he's asking, do you believe that neuropathy is caused by toxic long-chain lipid intermediates in the neuron, or do you think that's secondary to metabolic insufficiency?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think very hotly debated by people smarter than me at Inform. I think Melanie Gillingham is a great question for her, because I think she's wondering the same thing for the retinopathy, right? Like, why is this happening? I don't think we know. And then, what about the role of the inflammation? Right? Is there an inflammatory component? People have tried to stop this neuropathy with steroids, with IVIG, and is there going to be another role for a different immunomodulator, which is kind of why I put those in the slide deck as well. And again, more to say about that. But I think what we've seen I was in Pittsburgh when the triheptanone trials were happening, and I wish MCT, C8, C7, I wish that that was, the mainstay of therapy and that fixed everything. I don't know if it's a toxicity issue. That may be the best guess right now, but that may not be the end of the story. I think there's also some inflammation happening too.
There's another patient with L chatter. It's the caregiver, and they were curious if there's non-invasive tests for myopathy or neuropathy, such as like standing in a dark room with the lights off, or I know you had mentioned EMG, and I was curious, like, and muscle ultrasound, like if maybe like when do clinicians decide to use muscle ultrasound versus EMG? Would this be a possibility because an ultrasound isn't typically as invasive as a EMG is? But do you have any other thoughts in regards to non-invasive tests for neuropathy?
I mean, I think a good neuro exam is where to start, right? And then maybe some PT measurements, especially if you're at, an academic medical center. So I'm not just talking about taking your kid to physical therapy. I'm saying like go where they can do muscle strength testing, a 6-minute walk test, like some standardized measurements, and then do that periodically to see what's changed. But the neuro exam should also be strength, sensation, reflexes, I'm going to call it like the musculoskeletal exam, meaning like what is any changes in the feet, are there high arches, is there any atrophy, things like that. And so the exam itself should see, is there a neuropathy, is there a myopathy, and then of course the other test for myopathy is the muscle enzyme test, right? The CK level of the muscle, especially if the muscle is in, having rhabdo. A lot of people know what their baseline is, and then if they're in a flare-up of rhabdo. When to do muscle ultrasound, when to do EMG, I think, there's a time and a place for these tests. I think that they are, I don't, they are clinical-based tests. They can be done also on a research basis if we're following, I showed a lot of papers. We wanted to find out what's the median age that kids developed this. That was done on a research basis. They did EMG nerve conduction study year after year after year to determine when was the earliest that they could see symptoms of the neuropathy. But that's a painful study for a lot of people. I wouldn't sign up for, I'm kind of a wimp. I wouldn't sign up for having an electrical stimulation down my arm and then a needle put in my muscle. No, thank you. But I don't like going to the dentist either. These are painful. I would say, like, why do we need to get these? It does give us more information, but I only like them if it's like, well, we need to do it in order to get into a clinical trial or to provide better treatment. And this test is going to determine how we do that. Otherwise, we know when there's neuropathy or myopathy based on symptoms and based on the exam.
So another LCHAD patient asked, is it possible, because you mentioned that neuropathy typically presents symmetrically, but is it possible to present asymmetrically?
Anything's possible. I mean, when we're talking about this category of disease, there are no rules because there are, as soon as I say something and like this is how it always is, then I meet somebody who decides that they're the rule breaker. So typically it's symmetric, but it doesn't have to be.
So another patient asked if you could clarify small fiber neuropathy, how this is tested, because they had an EMG done, and their impression was, I think that I'm trying to reduce their question down, but maybe you could speak about small fiber neuropathy testing versus large fiber neuropathy testing.
Sure. So it's very, very different because the small fibers don't have myelin, right? So you're not going to be able to do a nerve conduction study. Nerve conduction study is testing the myelinated fibers and the conduction velocity on myelinated fibers. So when we're checking for small fiber neuropathy, or dysautonomia, there are a lot of different tests that you can do. Sometimes people will get a skin biopsy and they'll look at the small nerve fibers under the skin and to see like how it's like a count of how many are there and are they missing some nerve fibers. Sometimes there are all kinds of tests that people can undergo, and you don't necessarily have to undergo those tests. One of them is called QSART. It's like a quantitative sensory test that can be done. They can do like a sweat collection test using powder, like how sweaty do you get in a certain setting. Tilt table is one way that they can test dysautonomia, and that's when you go on a table and you kind of go upside down and they measure what's happening to your heart rate and blood pressure as you go upside down. And that's especially for people who have a tendency for syncope, and heart rate blood pressure changes as they change position. I know a lot of cardiologists that don't necessarily like those tests because they think that, your heart is supposed to change as you accommodate for those different positions. But, if those sometimes those tests can be very helpful in terms of determining are you having an exaggerated response to those changes. I would say that the definitive test for small fiber neuropathy is that skin biopsy, and there are kits that are made, and I think dermatologists can do them, and it's a quick punch, and then they mail it away, and then it can determine if you have a decreased number of small fibers or not, and then it can establish the diagnosis. But a lot of people will just say, well, if you have pain and you have symptoms that are either, equivalent to dysautonomia or small fiber neuropathy, then clinically you can make the diagnosis without the extra tests. There are some big centers that do this testing. Mayo has always had a program. I think Cleveland Clinic has had a program for this. But I have not personally sent people to those programs for testing. I've just said, it sounds like small fiber neuropathy. And then, there are specific medicines that can treat those symptoms as well, whether it's, heart rate fluctuations, blood pressure fluctuations, sweating, temperature instability.
How accurate are the small fiber neuropathy tests that are done that you just spoke of? Like, is it 90%? Like, if you test negative, that it's negative, or is it 99%?
Yeah,
Like,
I
what's
think
the.
the skin biopsy, I think, is the one that's kind of been the gold standard. The other tests, I think, have less sensitivity and specificity. They're not 100%.
Okay.
So I don't know how reliable they are. And again, like how are different physicians using that information? I don't know. So I don't really rely on that testing.
Okay, we have numerous more questions. I'm going to take a couple more, and then I will take pictures of everybody's questions and try to maybe we either come back and do another expert series, or because we do want to make sure everybody is heard. And I appreciate all of the amazing questions that were asked. You were just talking in regards to, well, a patient asked, is there medicine that can heal neuropathy, or is medicine more just to lessen the pain? And is there testing that isn't so painful? Because as you mentioned, the EMG is quite painful.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I don't know of other tests that are not as painful. I mean, other than the neuro exam, right? Like tapping on your reflexes. And then, the other test that a neurologist will do is, a little pin prick, which isn't that painful, right? But can you feel the pin? Is your thumb going, you close your eyes, is your thumb going up? Is it going down? Like what position is it in? Can you feel the vibration fork when I, do the tuning fork and you feel it on your thumb. So, you do vibration, position, pinprick, light touch, so all of those kind of things. So that, the exam is helpful. I don't know of any nerve regeneration therapies
Okay.
at this time. Yeah. So the symptoms are to, the medications are to help manage the symptoms.
This patient says that last year their daughter, who has Polgy, developed permanent numbness in her hand near a stroke-like event. She was then able to speak, so easy to communicate this. She's since had more stroke-like events and is currently unable to communicate movement and core muscles, but has not yet moved her extremities except with a seizure. Can nerve conduction studies show neuropathy during disorder of consciousness?
So for this person, I'm not sure if the loss is from the stroke-like episode, which my sense is that this is again, like maybe something happened in the sensory area of the brain that's leading to that arm. It might also be a combination of neuropathy, but because it happened during a, the stroke-like event, it sounds more of a central problem. They can do, this is a really good example of like when might you want to do EMG nerve conduction study to try to sort out how much of this is peripheral versus how much of this is central, and to try to distinguish the two. Would it be helpful? Or are you going to treat anything in a different way? Yeah.
So I'm gonna lead The last question I'm gonna leave with is from a genetic counseling student. She said, "Thank you so much for this presentation. The point about CMT and neuropathy foundations and resources, not including mitochondrial conditions, and particularly not including FAOD, stood out to me as a relatively easy way to make a difference. As a provider, are there particular resources or publications you would recommend for us to provide when reaching out to these organizations about adding information about mito FAOD conditions?"
Yeah, I mean, I think I was really surprised because I reached out to some of the CMT people and said, hey, you really need to have TFP genes on the panel and put it under the umbrella of CMT. And here's why. And they were like, okay. And I was like, well, oh, okay. I didn't know it was going to be that easy. Thank you. And then I think, for the Hereditary Neuropathy Foundation, getting that mito tab on there, that was parent driven. That,
Okay.
so I think, just continuing to educate is part of what we all do. So, I don't know how to say it any more than that, but just, if you stumble across a foundation, I mean, I do it all the time, right? Like, with the Epilepsy Foundation, I'm like, there's some mito diseases that you're not really covering with epilepsy. It's constant, right? Like, don't forget about mito. So
Yeah.
it's just part of what we do. And I think it's just when you're in the rare disease space, it's what we all have to do because they're thinking about the more common conditions. We just, we don't want to be forgotten. So just to continue to advocate, educate, it's what we all need to do in whatever space we're in.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Goldstein. We just so appreciate you tackling this huge topic and all of your wisdom and everything that you do for our community. So we just want to send a special thank you out to you and just everyone here. Thank you for coming and attending today, asking all of your amazing questions. And I will try to take pictures after the session and try to follow up with people. I hope that you guys will join us next month. We will have Dr. Dabare from Children's National joining us, and he's going to talk about how neuropathy affects the gut and gastroparesis. So the conversation will continue just in a little bit, kind of a different way. So thanks again, and looking forward to seeing everyone soon. Bye.
Bye.